Blog Talk Radio.
This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G. here along with Dr. Doug Lyle. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing today?
Good. How are you doing?
Well, not too bad. It's getting to be April showers bringing May flowers. Weather is kind of starting to change. It's been a little bit chilly today, but it makes me think of what happens with a lot of people that I've seen who get diagnosed with something called seasonal affective disorder, which is, I guess it's a fancy name for depression due to lack of sunshine. And of course, there's more to it than that, I'm sure, you know, but essentially that's what that is. So it got me thinking about depression and how, you know, sunshine is obviously not the only answer, but one of our listeners sent in a question recently to ask you saying, why do we get depressed and want to stay in bed all day long? And what is it that we can do about it?
Well, we get depressed because depression is going to be, it's designed as failure feedback. Okay, so just in the same way that happiness is the result of, is positive feedback, and the feedback systems are designed to signal increases or decreases in statistical likelihood of gene survival. So that essentially it's the signal of value. So the animal nervous systems are not cold machines that simply maneuver in a way to with some kind of a digital computer that's computing probabilities of survival and reproductive success. So that's what we mean by gene survival. So for people that don't aren't aware of, or relatively new listeners and not sure what the terminology is referring to, gene survival specifically is referring to the likelihood that the genes in that organism are going to be on the planet, you know, several generations out. That's what it is. So the that means that anything that increases the individual's likelihood of survival will increase their likelihood of gene survival. Because obviously, the longer you live, the more opportunity you have to reproduce. However, there are also other things that will increase the likelihood of gene survival other than your own survival. For example, if you do things that improve the probability of your children being sexually successful, then that will also increase the likelihood of your gene survival. Or if things happen that will increase your children's likelihood of survival. So your child has some disease that's going to cause them to die early, and then some genius figures out the solution for it, then we would expect that you would be very happy because that would be increasing the likelihood of your genes surviving. So that is the reason why I'm talking about this in some at some length, is to understand feelings. We have to understand that feelings are evolution's engineering design that tells the organism to what degree some event of significance to the organism, i.e. an event that has influenced any value, has either influenced that value is either a positive value or a negative value. In other words, if something does not matter to your gene survival, then it doesn't matter to your psychology. You just simply don't care. So whether or not, all kinds of stimuli that hit your nervous system are effectively neutral. In other words, you don't really have any emotional or affective response to these things at all, because you simply couldn't care less. Like right now, I'm putting my hand down on a table and just for the act of doing it. And as I do this, the table feels slightly cool relative to my hand, but other than that, it feels neither pleasurable nor painful. And so, therefore, I'm not apt to do this because it's not there's really no reason for me to seek to put my hand down on this table because there's no particular value that is being achieved by this. I'm not increasing my likelihood of gene survival by doing it. So your feelings are the translation of your mind's ability to essentially take in sensory events and to compute whether what is transpiring is likely to result in an increased likelihood of your gene survival or a decreased likelihood of your gene survival. And when it's an increase, you feel better, and when it's decreased, you feel worse. So what we call depression is actually a mood state that, you know, when people say, well, have you been, you know, how long have you been depressed for? Well, the answer is the person may have been depressed for an hour and a half, but then they had a six-minute respite when they were eating some Cheerios, and then they were depressed before that for an hour. In other words, the notion that you are sitting in a depressive funk without any respite is absurd. The I've talked to many depressed people and been able to say something humorous to them and watch them laugh, and for that 2 seconds or 3 seconds, they're not depressed. Okay, so the depression is a state that is telling the organism of the circumstances of which I am cognizant. The situation as I see it is not good for my gene survival. So this is why depression is the result of what we're going to call failure feedback. So the way the nervous system of a human is organized is that it has what we're going to call a self, and that self is a set of self-calibrations about its competitive standing with respect to targets of evolutionarily important actions. And those evolutionary important actions are specifically the esteem that they try to earn from mates, potential mates, friends and potential friends, and trading partners, people whom you have commercial transactions with. So those, you are forced into competition with other people in order to secure those relationships. You only pursue the relationships that you believe that you have the opportunity to secure. So if you are the 99-pound weakling at your school without any brains or wit, you don't try to hit on the prom queen. That isn't what you do. And you're not particularly depressed about that. You're depressed about the fact that there was Mabel over there who you thought would go to the prom with you, and because you didn't figure anybody else would ask her out. And when you asked her out, she said no. Okay? And so now you're depressed because now your expectations have been violated, and depression is the device the nervous system uses to signal to you that a goal that you put out energy in pursuit of has resulted in a lack of success that was not expected. That's what will cause depression. And so depression is a signaling device that has several functions, one of which is to get the organism to stop putting out energy in approach of that goal. Because the system is designed by nature as a life form is a device for essentially transforming energy into the genetic code. So if what your efforts have been up to have been unsuccessful at securing this esteem, then you are going to want to shut down that energy expenditure. So depression is a method for saying, hey, don't do it. So that's why people will slow down, sleep more, and do less. Now, it also has a host of facial characteristics and other communication characteristics, body posture, facial expression, even touch and somebody's handshake, the sound of their voice, the paralinguistic cues, the words that they choose. all kinds of communication signals indicate to the village that the person is depressed. This is not an accident. So this is a method for attempting to marshal up resources from the village to actually help the person get inputs that may help them in being more successful. So by signaling that you are depressed and miserable, some other individual might see this, and they see this as an opportunity in order to win a great deal of credit with you, okay? So if you are depressed and miserable and, looking like you've been crying or whatever, or just look like you're defeated, then the, quote, Good Samaritan is designed by nature to observe this and inquire. This is an advertisement that makes them look as if they are altruistic and compassionate and all this sort of jazz. And what they're doing, what they don't know that they're doing, is that they're actually profit-seeking. Because if one unit of their energy could aid and abet you significantly, then let's suppose that one unit of their energy aids and abets your survival and reproductive prospects by a factor of 50, which it very likely could in some circumstances. If that were the case, then you would feel heavily indebted to them, and they would have picked up, you would have easily been willing to put up 10 chips in exchange for the one chip that they spent, because they profited you 50 chips by the actions that they took, okay? And so you can imagine, for example, how useful it would be for a high-status person to go over and spend a few minutes with a low-status person and give, Elvis gives some little depressed guy his autograph. Well, now that guy can tell his friends what Elvis did and said to him. Elvis told me that I really had some talent and that I really ought to work on this and, I've got something here. Well, that could have a huge impact on that individual in their life. And as a result, they owe Elvis. And so they will now sing Elvis's praises forever. So by being depressed and signaling that depression with our communication channels, which are, facial expression, voice, words, body posture, touch, these are mechanisms by which we signal to profit-seeking, quote, altruists that it's a way to get help. Now, finally, we also are stumped. So we are surprised by the feedback in these competitive domains, and we don't know what to do. And so the frustration that you have, the unpleasant feelings that you have, drive creativity. So the brain starts searching up, down, and sideways for some way out of this, try to figure out why we're having the problem. There are multitudes of reasons, there's several of them. There are a limited scope of reasons why we do have the problem. One of the reasons is that we could be over-calibrated. In other words, we may simply have a somewhat narcissistic view of ourselves, and so are, for various and sundry reasons, it's either genetic or it could be as a result of historical accident in our lives, that we've simply overestimated ourselves. And as a result, the depression we're now getting is an inevitable recalibration process that is taking place that's not pleasant. But what it will do is it will lower our targets of action back to a more realistic level. So the example I give repeatedly to explain this, in other words, the lowering of a sense of self-confidence is a necessary and useful function of the brain, so that the organism doesn't continue to waste energy in pursuits of things that it's not competitive for. 85% of eighth grade boys believe that they will be professional athletes. Okay, so you can imagine that there's an extremely high percentage of eighth grade boys that are going to be disappointed in the feedback they get from the world about their competitiveness with respect to athletics. So both Alan Goldhammer and I, playing basketball in our young years, we both expected be playing for the Lakers one day. Okay. So it didn't quite turn out that way.
So there's always a chance. 65-year-old rookie.
So point is that both of us at our various junctures, he found out sooner than I did that he had no chance because he wasn't quite as good. Okay, but both of us ultimately discovered that we were not going to be professional athletes. So was it disappointing?
I sense a challenge
certainly
looming in the future.
Right. So did we? Was this a miserable, horrible, terrible thing to find out that we didn't have the chops? Of course not. And so there is no permanent psychological crime in not being able to reach a goal that one once had at all. And there's no terrible thing in this. It is necessary. The system cannot be born and then be so ingenious throughout its entire existence that it calibrates itself accurately to exactly what people and situations that it can compete effectively in. That would be impossible. The system has to generate hypotheses about what it may be able to do, and it then attempts to do those things and then finds out when it gets stopped. And when it gets stopped, the necessarily lowering of self-confidence is necessary to reduce the magnitude of the competitive advantage or competitive display that the person was seeking. And then they settle back down in and realize that they're just going to be a boring doctor and make a living that way instead of slam dunking and, you know, throwing behind the back passes. Good enough. Okay, now, so what we're going to see is that the solution to depression is going to be to first identify the domain in which the person is competitively frustrated. So it's very, very likely to either be in romance, in friendships, or in trade, i.e. business and employment process. Then what we want to do is identify the fundamentals where the competition is beating you over the head. So you are getting negative feedback, and we need to figure out what is it that people are doing that are similar to you that is better than you are doing. Why is it that this is happening? So I talked to a person recently with a sales job, and this person was getting negative feedback and might have been let go from the company, and essentially told me, "Hey, this is really not fair. I'm really doing a crackerjack job." And what I discovered was that they were not actually documenting what they were doing, and I can't remember exactly how I described this, but my two or three things came to mind, and that is that my sister was in a profession where they actually documented what they were doing every 10 minutes. So they work every 10 minutes and then they document. In my own profession, we work for an hour and then we document. But physicians, depending upon how many patients they're seeing and how often, they might be seeing 7 patients an hour. They might be seeing that patient for 3 minutes and then they're documenting for 3 or 4 minutes. So in this case, the salesperson was not spending nearly enough time documenting all the things they were doing. And I said, that's the most important hour that you're going to spend at the end of your day, by God, is you document the living daylights out of what it is that you're doing so that they can see what you're doing. And this is how you wind up being seen more competitively. So it isn't that you weren't doing the job, but you were not doing a critical part of the job, which is to make sure that you earn the people's respect. So there are fundamentals that your competitors may be doing better than you, which is causing you to have the negative feedback that you and the surprising negative feedback that you're getting that is causing your depression. So finally, get busy, because your competitors, you know, once you identify some fundamentals, don't whine about it. The truth is that you have not done as well as they've done. Maybe they've been in the weight room more. Maybe they've been, you know, doing the diet better. I just saw one of the more pathetic movies I've ever seen last night. It's called I Feel Pretty with the lead comics Amy Schumer. Mm-hmm. This is an amazing movie. I mean, I don't recommend that anybody see it, but if you did see it, you would see a 2-hour diatribe of a very self-pitying individual that basically is not doing what it takes to be as competitive as possible and basically whining about it. And so this is, your competitors don't care. You know, nobody's going to save you. So our job, if you're truly stumped, you may need to get help. You may need to get some direction. You may need to find some people that have knowledge of the fundamentals of whatever this competitive domain is that's got you frustrated. And then you need to start working on those fundamentals and improving your performance there. Now, this person also talked about sort of lack of energy and exercise. The truth is that in the Stone Age, you could not just sit and do nothing and lay in bed. You had to get up and move and be as effective as you could possibly be. I do believe that there's a problem in the modern environment that if you are depressed, and you're very depressed and stumped and demoralized, there are people that can essentially just lay in bed and not do much behind the energy conservation imperative that comes with being depressed. And this is a problem. And so I literally think neurochemically this is a bad situation, that it essentially sets up an exacerbation cycle on a number of fronts and keeps the person possibly in a state of depression that was meant to last for a few days or a week or two and might last for much, much longer because the person doesn't have to actually get up and start hunting or digging for potatoes. In other words, they don't have to put out many hours a day of the physical labor that is naturally necessary for a human being to not die by starvation. And so in the Stone Age, this depression is about issues where you are essentially socially in trouble, where you don't know what to do, and it will reduce your efforts at continuing to do things that the way you did them before, and you may feel demoralized, but you still have to get up every morning and hit the ball just as hard as you ever did with respect to your survival issues. So I have a feeling that's a problem in the modern environment that extends depression out much longer and much rougher than it's naturally designed to. So that's a long discussion on depression. If you don't know where to go to help, write to me. Call me. I'll tell you what to do.
Fantastic.
That's what I do. There's always a place to start. Okay. We identify the competitive domain. We hear what the situation is. We then figure out what on earth it is that the person should reasonably be attempting to do first to address the competitive deficit, and we attack. Okay. We attack with the attitude of we're going to learn something. Like we're not sure that we can identify exactly what it is that will turn the screw towards more success, but we can have at least a reasonable set of hypotheses about what will do this, and that is where we begin.
Fantastic. I really love your saying of rolling up our shirt sleeves because, anytime I feel down, I just think to myself, all right, got to roll up the shirt sleeves and figure out something to work on. And every time it's done the trick. So,
yeah, the great basketball coach, John Wooden, had, 100 maxims that were beautiful. And one of them is don't let what you can't do get in the way of what you can do. So if you feel stopped and depressed, you need to do something that you know advances your ball down the field. If you don't yet have figured out the biggest part of the competitive problem and you're not sure what you're going to do about it, that's okay. We're going to now do some research, find some people that may have the solution to that, et cetera. But in the meantime, between now and next Tuesday, when you're going to talk to that person, do what you can do. Do what you know is going to be useful. Get your house more in order. Get things more organized. In other words, don't let what you can't do get in the way of what you can do. And then remember, your competitors are not stopping. They are continuing to advance their cause. And so we need to get busy and get with it and get up and moving in an intelligent fashion. And get the help that you need to give you confidence that the direction that you're going in has some logic to it.
Fantastic. So Dr. Lyer, right. Where do families fit into this? So we've got mates, friends, and potential trading partners. What about families? Are they included in the friendship arena?
Yes. families are friends, hopefully. They're just a friend. There are friendships that have an additional evolutionary kicker, and that is that we are related to them genetically. So they are friends that have our genes located in them. So much so that they can be pretty contentious and pretty lousy and still worth it, because of the fact that if they suck some of your energy, that energy isn't going off into the evolutionary ether, where you don't get any benefit from it. It's actually going to your genes that are sitting inside their bodies. This is why there's so much more likely to be altruistic behavior within families than anywhere else. And that is also the reason for the phrase that blood is thicker than water. And that is the notion that when it gets right down to it, people are going to hang with family under conflicts because this is where the genes are sitting. So, yeah, all a family is it's a special case of friendship. And so it means that the relationships can be more conflicted and less pleasant and still more worth it because of the genetic commonality of interests. That doesn't mean that's going to trump. Blood is not ultimately thicker than self-interest. In other words, you are the most important thing in the universe, as far as I'm concerned. Your life is the most important thing that there is. And so even in family situations, it's possible. Just remember, most people don't qualify to be your friends, and most people don't qualify to be your mates. And so the truth is your family has an enormous upleg on qualifying to be your friend, just because all the people, first-degree relatives, all share 50% of their genes, for goodness sakes. It's like half of you is sitting in that individual. And so as a result, we are psychologically built to weave a close net of a commonality of interests that brings a cohesiveness to particularly first-degree relative situations. First-degree relatives would be sisters and brothers, children, and parents. Those are what first-degree relatives are. Second-degree relative is one thing over. That would be a niece or nephew. Notice how much vastly less psychological closeness there is between a niece and nephew relative to your own children. It's a vast divide. And what we've done is we've gone from 50% of your genes to 25%. And so suddenly we see that in the conflict of interest between a couple of cousins is going to be much greater than the conflict of interest between a pair of brothers over how altruistic one of them might feel. So families are essentially a special friendship category, but ultimately that's what they are. Actually, are you there? You're breaking up. I cannot hear Nate. So I do not know what it is that I'm not even sure that I'm still on. I'm going to assume that I am on. And you know what, folks? If you're listening, I think what we're going to do is I'm going to call back in case I'm now offline, and I'm going to see if we can reconnect and reestablish the podcast. Okay, so I'm hanging up now, and I'll be right back if I can. Bye.
All right, everybody, sorry about that. Looks like we have some technical difficulties, and I got kicked off of the stream instead of Dr. Lyle, but we've got Dr. Lyle back again. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing today?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh, I guess not. One second.
Hello? Nate?
Let's see
here. Are you there?
Oh, Nate, are you there? Dr. Lyle?
Yep. Good, I'm back.
Okay, sorry about that, everybody. We just got kicked off the stream for some reason, the internet connection. But we are now ready to welcome Amy from Minnesota. Let's try this again, see if that... Amy, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Hi
Dr.
there.
Dr. Lyle, when you were just talking, you made me think of mothers-in-law. My question is about how women can sometimes be so mean to each other and be their worst enemies.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about, like, there's a lot of support groups for women to try to help women in the corporate world. And if you could help help, like if you were to say something to some of the leaders in those organizations, what would you, how would you have them sort of structure the organization, or what sort of information would you give women on, so that it just it seems that sometimes women are either incredibly cooperative and sometimes fiercely mean to each other, and sometimes to the same people at different times. And I also think about how my dad, when I have three older sisters, and he was kind of leaning towards narcissism, but he played us against each other, and we, it was almost like the more we fought and ripped each other down or rooted against each other, the more of a thrill he got out of it. And and we've never been able to really have normal relationships ever since. We can see each other maybe once a year, and that's about before we get weird again and back into those old patterns, and then we kind of wait till the next Christmas. But I wondered what your thoughts are on that.
Well, those are two kind of different things, but they're sort of swirling around some similar principles. So let's just talk about this. So one of the things that essentially a mistake that people make in the world is let me try to spit this out if I can. People oversimplify the notion of the nature of coalitions. So people will believe that, for example, there's an old boys network and therefore you can't get in. It's the women against the men, et cetera, et cetera. This is not true. There are times and places where there are elements of this, but we have to understand that is really not how nature configures this organism. We are self-interested. And so we will join coalitions to the extent that those coalitions may further our personal interests, but we have conflicts of interest with everybody in that coalition to varying degrees. Every creature on Earth, every animal on Earth, essentially has a sentence stamped on their forehead that says, "My DNA is the most important thing on Earth," right out of The Moral Animal by Robert Wright. I mean, this is the ultimate conflict of interest. So, of course, I'm not surprised that if you have some "We the Women" group, you're going to walk out of there pretty confused, ultimately, because there's going to be tremendous infighting. There's going to personal agendas all over the place. Now, that doesn't mean that there might not be some other coalition out there that also is organized, because remember, you've got sort of hierarchical levels of conflict. So it's the Democrats against the Republicans. But within the Democratic Party, there's going to be phenomenal infighting as each of those individuals is leveraging for their own personal best interest, okay? And they come together only because they need to be together in a large enough organization in order to battle the enemy. And we're battling over resources is what this is. So you make a point that people – as you say, women can be incredibly cooperative. Let's broaden that. Human beings can be incredibly cooperative, just in general. Mm-hmm. Nothing special about women. So human beings are unbelievably cooperative. They are a stunning species in their ability to be cooperative. This is a result of their ability to form delayed reciprocal altruism type of agreements, where if I help you today, you're going to help me tomorrow. And it's also true that many of the competitive pursuits that they need to do involve, for example, hunting. So 10 guys can be unbelievably cooperative as their collective ability to survive depends upon all of them doing their part in an extremely dangerous process of hunting big game. Okay? So the so you're going to see that cooperation as a potential runs deep in the species. But don't think that when those guys get back to camp, they don't have total conflicts of interest about who gets credit, because everybody's trying to get laid. And so as a result, now the stories start about who really gets credit. And you're going to see, you know, all this in, you know, this is the big deal in the modern reporting of athletics is, you know, all the excitement is all about the insults that, you know, who insulted whom. That's a big deal. You know, those will create fissures in human relationships that will last for the rest of their lives at times. So people can be very cooperative, but let's not mask what the purpose of the cooperation is for. The purpose of me cooperating with anybody about anything is because it's going to advance my personal best interests. I couldn't give a damn about anybody else, ultimately. Okay? So does that mean, in other words, essentially what I'm after is, do I want them to, I would just as soon other people be successful as well. That would be fine. I have no agenda against them. But ultimately, the reason why I'm part of the group is for my own best interest, not the group's best interest. Okay? So so this is a rather simplistic, you know, I don't want to diss the entire process, because there's a time and place for groups who may have been walked over as groups to stand up collectively and to essentially find a way to impose costs on other groups that may be dominant over those resources and hold those feet to the fire and threaten them unless we have what? Fair play. Okay? So that's where it is that I see that this is potentially valuable. But, hopefully this answers your question, that if you're trying to understand anything about anybody's behavior at any time, the correct level of analysis is to think to yourself, what they are doing in order to win status. That's why they're doing what they're doing. And so there's only so long that can go where things are going to be cooperative, and then sooner or later there's going to be a conflict. Okay? So two guys, you know, build an architecture company together, and it's Smith and Wesson, fastest architects of the West. Yeah, I don't know. So the point is that sooner or later Wesson's going to be pissed off because his name's second, and there's going to be conflicts over it, who gets the bigger office or who meets the president, you know, et cetera. So I think this was, you know, semi-embarrassing and ridiculous when 30 or 40 years later, you know, Paul McCartney, once the love of his life, Linda, died, then he remarried this gal, and then this gal was raising a squawk about why it is that the songs had to be Lennon and McCartney. Why don't we reverse it? And, like, there was a big action about this. It's like, there you go. Yeah, everybody's fighting for status, you know, conflicts of this spectacular success. Now we look later, and some new chick is not happy about it. And so this is why it is that the cooperation is going to have limits. It can be useful, but if I were trying to talk to a corporation about how to have things run as well as possible, it would not be about empowering women or empowering minorities or empowering anybody. It would be about having standards as objective as possible of fair play across the board. That's what it would be. And whatever decisions were being made with respect to advancement or anything else, efforts would be made to try to have objective parameters for performance on which to decide those things. That's how you want it, okay, if you can. Good luck, because there's nepotism and essentially little group actions of our faction against your faction all over the place. So, but I think men versus women is a, in general, probably a relatively absurd place for anybody to try to be seeking fairness. All right, now, if we move on to the issues of your sisters with respect to your father, I think that what you're not seeing is entrenched issues that were sown by your father into the relationships of you and your sisters today. I think that what you're seeing is natural personality conflicts that are probably, there are probably individuals in this group that are inherently more disagreeable than others, and that there are, I think this is what it is that's actually transpiring. So whether or not you had the history of a parent, you know, with these psychological characteristics that was essentially distributing their parental investment depending upon, sort of capriciously, and therefore disturbing everybody's psychology around this, and somehow, you know, feeling that he was keeping everybody's attention directed towards him, like a narcissist very well might. I don't think that that actually has anything to do with the conflicts of interest that you're seeing in adulthood. I think the conflicts you're seeing in adulthood are far more a derivative of the personalities that are involved than the history. Okay?
That's really good news.
There you go. So that means you spend your time wisely investing in those relationships to the extent that they're valuable, and we avoid those relationships and we do not overlap our lives that much with them to the extent that they're contentious. The fact that they're sisters, you have Hamilton's rule voting for them. In other words, they are in principle more valuable than the average person on the street. But at the same time, if it turns out that, let's face it, you don't choose your family, okay, and you don't choose your parents. And so it can easily be the case that parents and family might be far away from qualifying to be your friend. And that the only reason that they're even remotely in the equation is because of Hamiltonian evolutionary logic. And so the so very often, you know, I will tell people, from the sound of it, these people are basically not a good investment of your time and energy. In my particular case, my nuclear family I was lucky. Both parents and my sister, I only have three people that mean anything. And those three individuals, we were all very tight. As we got wider than that, there wasn't anybody worth anything, not taught to us, not worth any time or energy to speak of.
Mm-hmm.
So it isn't that we dislike them, just the cost-benefit of maintaining relationships of any significance just simply wasn't worth it. They weren't bad people, but they weren't as good as the cost-benefit we could get by making friends. So Alan Goldham and I have known each other for 50 years. I am way closer to him than I would be with any cousin, just because of the nature of the cost benefit. So if family's not that great, then they're not that great, and we don't worry about it. Make sense?
That's extremely helpful. Yes, that's extremely helpful.
Okay.
Would you mind commenting on the dynamic of mother-in-law? Because you would think that she'd like her daughter-in-law because you're passing on her genes, but they're always, it's just, you know, the stereotypical mother-in-law who's so mean. What's going on? Is she losing status with her son? Is she threatened by the youth?
Actually, that's really good. Good question. The probably, you know, I haven't thought too much about this. One of the things that's remarkable in humans is that a host of extraordinary characteristics psychologically of humans is that parents could give a damn about who their children are mating with. I don't believe that there's any influence anywhere in the animal kingdom of a parent attempting to influence the mating behavior of an offspring. And yet, in humans, this is huge. It's a major issue. This speaks to the huge brain that a human being has, as it runs computations and maps out its best interest in the most complex of ways. Much more very subtle, complex political maneuvering that takes place in humans. I don't care what they say about chimpanzee politics. They're not even remotely in the same class as human politics. You know, a 7-year-old human would run circles around any chimpanzee politically. And so in the same way that one of the things that we see in human mating behavior that makes it remarkable is that human beings are incredibly fussy because these are high investing species. It's a very low reproduction species, and as a result, every child is pretty damn valuable, and therefore and is requiring a lot of input from males. So it's a heavily pair bonded species. So you're going to find that in this, what we're going to see is very high. You're going to see a striking narcissism that paints human mating behavior, where people are thinking that they're worth 10% more than they are. And so this is why you've got 90 million single people, despite the fact that you've got Tinder and Match.com, that people are like, no, not good enough, 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 not good enough. Mm-hmm. Now, it's going to turn out that very same vision is sitting in the head of your mother-in-law. Okay, so even though you may have qualified for your husband, you didn't qualify for your mother-in-law. So your mother-in-law can be thinking, nah, not good enough. Okay, she's really not good enough. You could have done better, okay? And if you can imagine this characteristic, that if you think of people on how agreeable or disagreeable they are, and I'm going to assume that if you've got a tough mother-in-law, that your mother-in-law isn't just disagreeable with you. She's probably disagreeable with everybody. So she's a disagreeable mother-in-law is not just a disagreeable mother-in-law. It's a disagreeable human. There's a lot of wonderful mother-in-laws in the world. Happen to be sweet people. But if you think of a mother-in-law that is sitting at, the 70th percentile for disagreeability, and then you tack on to the fact that she's your mother-in-law, so now what is she thinking? You weren't nearly good enough for my husband. Mm-hmm. For my son. So now she might as well be essentially encouraging that relationship to break apart. Okay? She would just as soon he move on. She would just as soon he inseminate some other female who's fancier, the more deserving of him in her eyes. Okay? Mm-hmm. So I don't doubt that evolutionary process is embedded, you know, not only embedded naturally. I had a childhood friend of mine, finally got married. She was like 48. So she finally got married, and her parents, who were people that were friends of mine, you know, when I was growing up, they were amazingly gracious at the wedding, and they were their attitude. I said, well, it looks like, you know, she just did great. This guy seems like a nice guy. And both of the parents' reaction was, yeah, he is, but he didn't have to be. We would have taken anything. Okay? So I have no doubt that lady is a wonderful mother-in-law. You know what I'm saying? But that's going to be rare. Most of the time, parents are grumbling and feel like their genetic team got a little bit of the worst end of the deal. And so in your particular case, I think it's probably a little bit accentuated by the underlying disagreeability of your mother-in-law. That makes sense?
Yes, thank you. That clears up a lot.
Yeah, keep them at a distance and defend your relationship against that kind of toxic waste.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
all right.
Thank you, Dr. Lyle.
My pleasure.
Amy, thank you very much for the phone call. I really appreciate it. Great questions. So, Dr. Lyle, can we take one more question before we end the show?
One more. Go ahead.
Okay. So a couple of years ago, this is kind of similar to the question that we had earlier about depression, but a couple of years ago I read a really funny article about a young man who he was so depressed that he decided that his last act of life would be to go to Mexico. He lived somewhere in Texas or California. But he would drive down to Mexico He would buy a drug that I think it was a barbiturate, and that he wanted to kill himself because he was just so sick of living. Things had gone so bad. And he decided if he was going to die anyway, he might as well hire a prostitute in Mexico, which he did. And the cab driver on the way to the place offered to give him cocaine. And he ended up spending the entire weekend with prostitutes and cocaine and decided that life really wasn't as bad as he thought it was and decided not to commit suicide. He drove back and ended up bringing his life back into balance for some reason.
Yeah.
So, of course, not that that's recommended at all, but I was reminded of this because of the next question from one of our listeners, which is, what do you think about the, quote, revelations that people claim to have under the influence of certain drugs, like psychedelics, and otherwise people feeling like they're, quote, one with the universe? Can these experiences really help and change people, or are they just similar to those brilliant drunk ideas that we seem so stupid once we wake up in the morning? And follow-up question is, can LSD or similar substances be useful in psychotherapy?
Interesting question. I wouldn't have considered it an interesting question, but somewhere along the line in the last 6 months, I read that Sam Harris thought that he had been greatly aided by, I don't know, his use of ecstasy or whatever the hell it was, which really surprised me from a guy that to me seems like incredibly sharp and extremely logical. So generally, I would also say let me think about how I would formulate this. It would be possible in the same way if we were to take a hot cotter and to drive it into your abdomen, it's exceedingly unlikely that it's going to do any good, and it may kill you from internal injuries. However, it could also be the case that if you're bleeding to death and we go in there and hit that with a hot cotter, that we save your life. So extraordinary things might occasionally happen as a result of damage to the brain. So you could see in principle that someone let's suppose someone had some really debilitating OCD and they get in a car accident, they get a concussion, and then it turns out it's gone. It's like, could that happen? Absolutely it could happen. It's not going to happen very often. Actually, a movie was made on this theme 30 years ago. It was a beautiful movie. It was called Regarding Henry with Harrison Ford and whoever the gal was that wound up marrying Warren Beatty, Annette Bening, I think. And anyway, it was beautiful. It was a story of a guy who had been obviously a very cold, disagreeable, very successful attorney that gets, I think, shot in the head, survives, and it turns out he turns into this wonderful guy, even though he's disabled, but he's wonderful. And essentially has a personality change. Now, how often could such a thing happen? Not very often. Almost always it's going to go the other way. So if you damage the brain, things are going to get worse. So the idea of, say, LSD to be helping something, I'm going to be thinking, really? I already know that psychotropic medications that have gone through considerable effort to try to find a use for them, I believe are basically almost a total loser. They're a loser as far as I can tell systematically. They would not be – you can't write them off as an unsystematic potential benefit. In other words, if you had some quirky circuit that it might be true that someday they identify a drug that if you take it accidentally – and completely unpredictably, it happens to help you, okay? So do I believe that something like LSD is going to be helpful psychotherapeutically? No, I don't. Do I rule out the possibility that somebody might have some quirky circuit, like they're just freaking terrified of spiders, and one day they snort some LSD, and then it turns out they're never afraid of spiders again? Do I think that that's possible? Yes, I think it's possible. But I don't think it's going to be systematic. so that's how I look at it. So I think in general, any attempt to mess with the neurochemistry of the brain is likely, it's probably exceedingly likely to be a step backwards. This would be the equivalent of, you know, is there damage that we can do to a system to improve it? If I have my knee that's working as well as my knee can work, you know, can I go in there and do surgery and improve it? Not likely. Now, if there's damage already done in there, is there surgery that I can do to help it? Maybe. And so the future holds theoretical promise for psychotropic disturbance of brain chemistry and possibly electromagnetic disturbance of brain chemistry, et cetera. I don't think at this time there is much promise, and I think by far the greatest promise is in realizing that the brain's the emotional trials and tribulations that people have are related to their struggles with the competitive processes of gene survival. And the overwhelming majority of success is going to be had in doing two things. Number one, either helping that pursuit, or to the extent that people have individual quirky problems, to try to make their environments work in such a way that they're a better fit for those people's personalities. So we don't send our ducks to Eagle School. We don't put introverts in a New York deli working behind the counter. And we don't put OCD people in situations that you know, have their brains go crazy. And in essence, what we try to do is we try to be as successful at living as we can. And I don't think that we it would be in rare instances that I think that we would ever reach for a method of damaging the brain or its function in order to try to improve outcomes.
Fantastic. Again, in the concept of intervention over confidence, is
yes.
I assume as we're always trying to do something.
Right. Very.
I remember reading a political commentator who said that Congress is in the same way. They said, don't just sit there, spend something. And I guess
right.
It's the same thing when we're trying to do
very
new things for humans.
Perfect. Perfect. You got it.
Dr. Lyle, thank you very much, as always. I will look forward to talking to you next week.
My pleasure. Terrific.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.